It's time for Money for Lunch, where we feed your brain and your business with supersized portions of business and financial news. Now your host, Bert Martinez.
All right. Welcome to Money for Lunch, where we're talking about you and your business, as well as your life, because Money for Lunch is about not only about helping you in your business area, but helping you in your life in general, right? We have a great show lined up for you today. My first guest, Francis Jackson. Francis Jackson is a disability attorney who specializes in disability law for those seeking veterans disability benefits and Social Security disability benefits. He's a founding partner of Jackson McNichol. He has been featured on NBC, CBS, ABC, and Fox Networks affiliates around the country. Most recently, appeared as a guest of Ben Glass on the Consumer Advocate Show discussing benefits of for veterans and Social Security disability benefits. And now, his practice allows him to make a difference in the lives of people facing disabilities. He has been quoted in USA Today and listed in the Cambridge Who's Who. Mr. Jackson was honored by the National Academy of Best-Selling Authors with a Quillie Award in September of 2012 for his contribution to the best-selling book, Protect and Defend, where he wrote about protecting one's rights to veteran disability compensation, as well as being a regular contributor on Money for Lunch. Francis Jackson, welcome to Money for Lunch.
So much, Bert. It's always a pleasure.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know what? And I've said this numerous times. I think the work that you guys do there at Jackson McNichol is so important, because there's just not enough people helping our veterans. And sometimes these guys are dealing with, you know, with injuries and mental issues. And then on top of that, they are being asked to jump through all these we call it hoops and dig through all this red tape to try to get their benefits. So I appreciate what you guys do there. I think it's so vitally important.
Well, thank you, Bert.
Hey, let me jump into this. And this is kind of a tough subject, but I want to talk about this because it's constantly in the news, and we keep hearing about suicide among veterans becoming a big problem. Is anything being done about that, as far as you know?
Well, there is, Bert. What's going on, as you know, the national statistics are that about 22 veterans commit suicide every day, which is a pretty staggering number, really. But what the VA has done is to set up a suicide prevention hotline that vets can call. The downside is that, like a lot of other projects within the VA, there's not enough money to go around, so sometimes the hotline isn't staffed, and if you're suicidal and you call the hotline and they say, gee, please call back, it's really not very helpful. So what's going on is there's some legislation in Congress right now. It's called the No Veterans Crisis Line Call Should Go Unanswered Act, and while the title is perhaps a bit of a mouthful, the intention is good, and what it's intended to do is to make sure that crisis hotline is funded and staffed 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, which I think is a really important and vital goal. The problem is that, as you know, we're in the midst of one of the nastiest political seasons anybody's seen in a long time.
Right.
And where now there's a big session of finger-pointing in the Senate about who's responsible for holding up this bill that hasn't been passed. And, of course, the Republicans are blaming the Democrats, and the Democrats are blaming the Republicans, and the net result is nothing's happening. The good news is it does look like the bill actually has considerable support on both sides of the aisle, and my best guess is that when Congress comes back after the election, it's probably going to get passed. But it's just another sad example of how unpleasant the current political climate has gotten, that the things that are really pretty obviously desirable from everybody's point of view don't get acted on, a lot of finger-pointing and blaming. It's just unfortunate.
Yeah, you know, it is a terrible thing that something as a no-brainer, something as so, we'd call it simple as, manding these phones, has to be legislation. It's just crazy. It should be a no-brainer. But unfortunately, as you and I have discussed several times, you know, because the DOD is such a huge part of the budget, and I think that the Veterans Affairs is such a big thing that nothing simple can get done easily.
It certainly doesn't seem that way. It's an awfully large and cumbersome bureaucracy. But I do think in the long run, this is finally going to get taken care of.
Yeah, and I sure hope so. Our veterans deserve it. And anyway, hopefully they'll get it quicker. Let's talk about this. I want to shift subject and talk about Iraq and Afghanistan veterans. Has there been any developments affecting the veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan?
Well, as you know, Bert, that's a little closer to our usual topic here about money. So let me talk about that. What's going on is that a lot of veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan have developed various illnesses that seem to be traceable to this big burning campaign for dealing with all the refuse from the war. They referred to as burn pits, and a number of them were run by American contractors. Others were run by Afghanis. But the thing is, what they did was like wrecked equipment or really any kind of stuff that was no longer useful or usable. They just threw it in these burn pits, and so you have all these strange chemicals being emitted in the smoke and troops being exposed to it. And there's a big push currently with the Department of Veterans Affairs to create some presumptions of service connection for people suffering from those kinds of exposures, because some of these are pretty bad chemicals. For example, some of the toxins that were given off in the smoke include dioxins, the kinds of things that were in the Agent Orange defoliant in Vietnam, and we know what kind of problems those have caused. But the big thing that has happened is that the Supreme Court just ruled that a series of lawsuits against the primary contractor, KBR, and its parent company, Halliburton, which you may recall our former vice president had big holdings in. Anyway, the Supreme Court allowed the lawsuits against KBR and Halliburton to go forward, despite objections by both the government and the contractors that the contractors were acting in pursuit of national policy and on behalf of the U.S. and therefore should be immune from suit the same way that the government is. But the Supreme Court said, no, these suits can go ahead. So the net result is that there are several lawsuits pending that are now going to be able to go forward to try to get compensation for veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan who've been the subject of these inhaled chemical problems. And, you know, it doesn't sound like a big deal. You know, you're exposed to a bunch of smoke, but a lot of these folks are dying. It's really not very pretty. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, how the civil justice system grapples with these kinds of cases. They're really technically quite difficult, but at least at this point, even though there has not been a presumption entitling these folks to veterans benefits yet, although that may happen, at least the civil lawsuits are going ahead. So that's a start, and hopefully, ultimately, Congress or the VA will approve regulations for veterans benefits that are directly related to these claims. But right now, it's primarily the lawsuits.
Sure, sure. Well, you know what? And this is no different than what we've seen in any kind of other industrial type of situation where people are exposed to smoke or dust. And unfortunately, it was something that wasn't maybe necessarily expected. So there wasn't any research, and proper care was not enacted, right? They weren't anticipating bad effects, so therefore the men and women who were around the smoke or whatever, these chemicals, weren't protected correctly, and therefore this is the cause and effect of it. I'm glad to hear that the lawsuits are going to go ahead, but let me ask you this. What makes these things so difficult? It seems like now that the courts have said, hey, it's okay to sue, and we seem to have a direct link there, what are some of the things that these guys have to overcome?
Well, the big problem is proving from a technical medical point of view that the particular smoke exposure caused the specific illness that people are having. You know, there are lots of different problems here, and part of the issue is that there's just a huge variety of stuff that was burned, whether it was waste oil or fuels or old equipment, old plastic and vinyl, all kinds of stuff that we know has toxic effects, but proving that that's the particular cause of a particular cancer or other disease in an individual person is challenging. I mean, it's like the cancer cases. You know, there are many, many carcinogens, but if you've ever been a smoker, for example, the defense is always, well, sure, maybe you were exposed to this carcinogen or that carcinogen, but you've smoked, and so probably you got your cancer from that. You know, it's just technically difficult to tease out the causation and make it stick in every case.
Yeah, you know what, when you explain it like that, it kind of makes sense. People have to look at what these individuals were doing, and it just goes to show you that even though one side sees a clear and direct link, the other side can make an argument that no, maybe it isn't that clear, and it's a tough call, and luckily we are not going to have to make that. Somebody much smarter than me anyway is going to be making that call.
And I don't get to make that call either, Bert. But I do think there's some pretty good science on the side of the folks who are seeking these benefits. So I'm hopeful that they will ultimately prevail.
Gotcha. Let's talk about this. I want to talk about the developments there for the Marines and the Navy personnel stationed at Camp Lejeune. What's going on there?
Well, as you may remember, that's another one of these toxic exposure issues. What has finally come out is that the water supply at Camp Lejeune, which served the entire base, including civilian housing as well as the service personnel, has been contaminated with chemicals since probably the 50s. What's going on now is that there are regulations being worked on by the Veterans Affairs Department that would presumptively service connect certain kinds of cancers, in particular, for people who were stationed at Camp Lejeune for at least a minimum period of 30 days. The regulations haven't been finalized yet, and currently there's a big push by Congressman Jones from North Carolina, which is, of course, where the base is, to argue that you shouldn't have to prove even that you were on the base for 30 days, that as long as you prove you were there at all, that should be sufficient. And as you said in relation to our earlier discussion, we'll leave that to smarter people to figure out exactly how long you should have been exposed. But it does appear that that is finally coming to a head. It's not at all clear what's going to happen to the folks who were civilians, particularly Navy or Marine dependents who lived on the base. There's no mechanism really for compensating those folks through the VA, so it's unclear what's going to happen with those poor people and the medical problems they've developed. But at least for the veterans who served and were stationed there, it does appear that within the foreseeable future, at least, the regulations are probably going to be finalized and implemented to allow those folks to kind of skip over the proof that their cancer was caused by this exposure and get a presumption that it was caused by the exposure, so that make it easier for them to get benefits.
Sure, sure. And when you're talking about the civilians and the dependents there, the reason that it's unclear as to what's going to happen is, and you correct me if I'm wrong, is that when you're suing a government or a government entity, the government has a lot of leeway, right? I mean, in other words, the law gives them a lot of flexibility, in some cases immunity, where a company wouldn't have such immunity. Is that right?
That is right. And the second part of the problem is that, generally speaking, there are statutes of limitation that apply to claims outside the VA, so that when you're suing the government under the Federal Tort Claims Act, for example, which is sort of the category that this would probably fall into, you have to have given the government notice of a claim within 2 years, and we'll just have to see what the courts do with that. Sometimes they talk in terms of 2 years after you develop the illness, or 2 years after something should have put you on notice that that there was a connection between being exposed here and the illness. Or there are kind of different ways they courts have dealt with those issues over time, but it's just not clear yet where is all going in terms of what happened to non-military personnel. But the VA is having the comment period on the proposed regulations right now. It just ended last week, and so they're now in the process of taking those comments and kind of putting that all together to decide what they're going to do in terms of final regulations. But it does look like there is going to be a regulation that presumes that several very specific diseases were caused by that exposure, which will be a real benefit for people who are suffering from those things, because they're otherwise hard to prove.
Sure, sure. And I'm curious, and I don't know if you know the answer to this or not, but since Camp Lejeune was dealing with this, what do you call it, this pollution or this contamination since the 50s, when did they discover it? Did they discover it in the 50s and 60s, and it's taken this long to get it to correct it, or did they, or is something that they just discovered a few years ago?
Well, it's sort of yes and no. What's happened is that they discovered the pollution a while back, but it wasn't until fairly recently that the medical science was sufficient to tie some specific diseases to the chemical exposure. As you and I have talked about in other contexts, just being exposed to a chemical doesn't necessarily mean that you get sick. Some people do, some people don't. Some people get sick for other reasons. So it's kind of had to wait for the medical science to kind of catch up and figure out, okay, if you get exposed to these chemicals, then it's likely to cause this. So that's the best way I can explain why it's kind of taken until now. But that seems to be sort of the primary thing, if you will.
Sure, sure. Hey, you know, well, I know a while back you and I talked about, what do you call it, different legislation for hiring vets and things like that. Anything happening when it comes to hiring vets right now?
Yeah. As you may remember, when we talked about that before, what's been going on is for a number of years we've had what's called a veteran's preference, so that if you apply for a government job and you're a veteran, you qualify for kind of extra points on the test. So, you know, you get a little bit of a leg up. And the bill that has been under consideration would restrict that preference to your first government job. So say, for example, that you apply to become a clerk at the post office, you get that preference the first time, but then you apply to get moved up to a supervisor. Under the new bill, under the proposed bill, you wouldn't get the preference in that second job. So what's happened is there's been a lot of back and forth about that in Congress, but I think it's probably now going to quietly die away because Senator McCain has come out against that change, and he's the Senate lead negotiator on matching the House bill and the Senate bill. So in all probability, the fact that he's opposing it means that that provision is going to go away, and in turn that the existing veterans preference legislation, which gives you the preference in any job application, whether it's your first one or your 27th, would continue. So it looks like veterans who were trying to move up in the government will continue to have that benefit, and they can breathe a sigh of relief, it looks like.
Sure, sure. You know what, and I don't necessarily, see a big problem with that because there are other conditions involved. I mean, just because you serve doesn't automatically mean you get the job. You just get a second look or possibly a third look. I don't think there's anything wrong for that when somebody's risked their life to protect our rights and our way of life.
I agree with you, Bert.
Let me ask you this. Any other important new developments happening there for our veterans or in the area of disability or anything like that?
Well, there is one very interesting thing that's just come out, and it's too early to call it really a development in the benefits area yet. But there's some new research that has just come out regarding PTSD that has kind of, I guess the best way to say it is, it's sort of taken a lot of research that's been done and offered a theory that sort of makes it all fit together in a more coherent way. There's been, as you can imagine, lots of research about PTSD and why is it that some people who get exposed to dangerous and stressful situations develop a problem and other people don't seem to, and, you know, is there some kind of predisposition or some genetic issue? And nobody really has made a lot of headway on that. There are lots of little pieces of research, but there's a new kind of theory, if you will, that has just come out from a couple of University of Michigan Medical School professors who have been looking at this for a long time. And they say that what they think is happening is that people who have PTSD have a fairly specific disruption. If take, for example, if you see a mountain lion in the zoo, you know, not scary, no big deal. If you see the same mountain lion wandering around in your backyard outside of a cage, probably pretty scary. And what these folks have theorized is that the problem is in the neurochemicals in the brain that help to sort out when the fight or flight mechanism that we all have should kick in. And it's some kind of interesting stuff. It's probably years from actually having any on the ground benefit in terms of helping people to establish their entitlement to benefits or to sort out who's entitled to benefits and who's not. But it's a very interesting piece of theory about PTSD, and maybe pushes us a little bit closer to understanding what's going on, and even more important, maybe a way to improve that condition for people who have it.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know what, Ann? The exciting thing about that research is that if we can figure out what's doing it, then maybe we can protect those individuals in advance, or we can treat them better, because it is such a difficult thing to treat.
That's for sure. It has been proven very, very refractory to treatment. It's you know, a lot of the folks that we help with their claims from the Vietnam era have really just suffered terribly as they've gotten older. It seems like, for whatever reason, people kind of are, maybe it's just that young people are more resilient, I don't know, but what we've seen in a lot of our clients is that as people have gotten older, the PTSD problem has gotten more and more severe for them, to the point that it's harder and harder for them to deal with other people and to really function, and it's a terrible problem. And I'm very hopeful that this research and other research will eventually lead us toward a better treatment.
Absolutely, absolutely. Francis Jackson, we're out of time, but I'm looking forward to seeing you here in the great state of Arizona next month, and maybe grabbing some dinner with you. Always good to have you on the show, my friend, and I'm glad that you're out there protecting our veterans. If you guys want to connect with Francis Jackson, you can go to jackson-mcnichol, MacNichol.com. He'll be glad to take care of you, answer your questions, and point you in the right direction. Francis Jackson, we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks a lot, Bert. Good to be here.
Good stuff there from our Action Jackson, Francis Jackson. He'll take care of you, our fighting men and women, or our veterans, I should say, with your disability concerns. You can reach out to him and his team at jackson-mcnichol.com. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and then we'll be back right after this.
Welcome back to Geico Radio. It's savings on the radio.
Caller Steve, go right ahead.
Yeah, I just got a free rate quote on geico.com. Saved a ton, and it only took me 5 minutes and 12 seconds. I was wondering, is that some sort of record?
That's a good question. Then let's have a look.
Not quite. Someone's got you beat by 8 seconds.
Still, I mean, that's quite fast.
Well, what if I told you I only use one hand?
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
Hey, good news, everybody. You know, Tom Cruise is just releasing his movie, Jack Reacher. This is the sequel to his last Jack Reacher movie. And they're releasing it on my birthday this weekend. I kid you not. What a wonderful birthday gift from my good friend who I've never met, Tom Cruise. So thank you to Tom Cruise and the Jack Reacher people for doing that. What a nice gift. Anyway, enough of that. My next guest, Andrew Ajemi. Andrew Ajemi has been teaching sound financial principles, whether through the format of a seminar or one-on-one. Andrew enjoys helping people use these principles to ascertain the financial strategies that pertain to their personal situation. Andrew maintains a commitment to objective planning in the area of conservative retirement income strategies and the allocation of assets that preserve capital as well as allowing for growth. For many years, Andrew has been named a 5-star wealth manager, has seen a as seen in Connecticut Magazine, Wall Street Journal, and the like. He also has enjoyed a higher rating with the Better Business Bureau for many years, as well as National Ethics Association. Andrew Ajemi, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Thanks, Bert, and happy birthday coming up here, man.
Yeah, man, I'm going to milk that as much as I can. I mean,
good
on.
For you. Let's start it early, right? Have
absolutely.
It go the whole week long, man.
Absolutely. Well, let's jump into this because, you know, this has become such, such a huge concern for people, especially after,
yeah.
you know, we've seen that in 2007, 2008, where people just lost 40, 50, 60% of their investment portfolio. And so let's talk about this. I mean, let's start off by talking about what happened to the traditional pension plan, because I don't think that's around anymore, really.
For the large companies are disbanding that, getting rid of those. A lot of places, you know, that have those today would be primarily the government. Whether it's the federal government or municipalities of some sort, they're really the as far as big organizations, really the ones that are left with those. It's kind of interesting, you know, a lot of smaller companies, when I say smaller, I'm talking like definitely under 100 employees, maybe more like 20 or so, are actually, it's a very big thing for these companies that is able to help the employees as well as the owners in that. But generally speaking, yes, they are going away. They're a thing of the past. Used to be, you know, our parents, you know, they could work for whatever, 30, 40 years at the same company, retire with a pension and be happy, you know, live well. But that's not happening these days. They're doing away with that because in the interest of profits to the company, regulations and so forth, those are being done away with. You know, that presents a situation where people have to save for retirement themselves.
Which is not necessarily a bad thing. And what's interesting here, especially for people of my age, I'm in my 50s, you know, it was so taboo. It was so frowned upon. Considered a loser, a loafer, lazy if you couldn't hold a job, right? If you were one of those guys who were going from job to job to job to job, you were like a pariah, man. People left you alone. You know, nowadays that's also, as you mentioned, gone away. I mean, that's kind of the thing. I know several people who have changed jobs at least 5 times in the last 10 years.
Yeah. Yeah. That happens quite a bit. And, you know, and what has happened with this whole thing, you know, well, number one, if you don't have the pension, there's not a reason. One of the things the pension did was it encouraged people to stay. I was in a municipality just last week where it was really kind of funny, Bert. I was talking to this lady who said, I'm leaving this municipality and going to work for the state. And she says, you know, I have a pension, and, you know, I'm just about vested. I said, what are you talking about, just about vested? She said, well, I have to be 10 years to be vested. That way it's my pension. I'm leaving this month, but I vest next month. I said, what, are you kidding me? Don't leave this month if you're vesting next month, because you'll give that whole pension away. But the idea behind those were that, you know, it was a way to kind of like lock the employee in for the long term, because if they wanted those benefits, they had to stay. And, you know, and so then they became, you know, kind of loyal to the company from that standpoint. And that's been gone away, you know, that's going away. And then with that, people are not staying from that standpoint. So that creates a problem. And what that does then is it shifts these people who are going from job to job. They're not realizing it's shifting the responsibility for the retirement to themselves. You know, in the old days, like I said, it was based upon the company. Now, it's going to be based upon them. You know, some people say, well, Social Security would take care of me. Well, Social Security was never designed to be a retirement program. It was designed to be a widows and orphans benefit. You know, back when it started in the 30s, people would retire at 65 and they die a year later. So they still had women, you know, back to widows and orphans to take care of from that standpoint. And, you know, but today it's easy to live on Social Security for 20, 30 years after you start collecting it. But even with that, it's not it's not what you know, it's not necessarily enough to keep people out of cat food, you know. To keep, you know, you want to stay out of that cat food stuff, right? And out of that dog food stuff. You want to be able to have enough money where you don't have to buy that. Go after that. So it's shifted the responsibility when from that standpoint, and so that creates a problem.
Yeah, yeah. You know what's interesting, and first of all, I want to say this, that I think it's probably a good thing that, as you mentioned, the responsibility has shifted from the company to the employee.
Right.
The bad news is that the responsibility has shifted from the company to the employee, right? It's both good and bad. You know, with the pension plan, it was automatic. I didn't have to worry about it. Now
right.
I have to worry about it. And for a lot of us, this is overwhelming because there's so many choices out there. And what makes it even worse is that not all financial people have the same fiduciary responsibility. Some people have the designation of a fiduciary fiduciary. Some
yep.
people have a designation
yep.
of a broker, and that,
yep.
that designation allows them to sell, you know, junk or, you know, stuff that maybe they shouldn't be selling versus the people who
right.
are restricted to doing what's best for their clients.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, that's a very interesting thing when you say that because you know, there's two sides of that coin, and I understand exactly what you're saying, and I am a fiduciary. But that's a whole nother discussion. I'm not going to go there. you know, you're on track with that, and you know, too many times people are going to people who they think they're in having their best interests in mind, but ultimately may very well not. And it doesn't hurt the financial person as much as it hurts the you know, the person with the money kind of thing, the employee or who what have you. But you know, one of the things that has you know, they've done a study recently that kind of describes how people who have college educations are more likely to contribute to their 401k plans, thus saving for retirement. And they're more likely, not only are they more likely to contribute to these plans, but they're also more likely to contribute more than their counterpart who maybe did not have a college education. And, you know, it's really an interesting thing because there are a lot of smart people out there that don't have college educations. But there are also a lot of people that don't have college educations that don't know some of the things that the people at college have learned, and it ends up creating potentially a problem in the future, a disparity between those in retirement with what they have from you know, what they've been able to save because of that.
Go ahead.
Well, one of the things happens so many times is that people do not get educated. And when you're talking about, like, you know, that financial salesperson, they're typically interested in the sale rather than in, you know, helping the people and educating the people. And, you know, this is one of the things that when I got into business 26 years ago, I saw, hey, this is cool. I'm coming from the ministry into this financial service industry, which is great. You know, ministry is service, the financial industry is service. But what I realized quickly was it's kind of oxymoron. It's kind of like not the financial service industry, it's the financial sales industry. And this fiduciary thing you're talking about tends to, you know, to try to get that out of that to be more service. But what happens, it's not that I'm against selling things, it's how you sell them. And, you know, my approach is how important education is. Now, whether that's a college education or it's being educated But being able to get the information you need to be able to make an educated decision. And that's what I appreciate about you, Bert, having this these radio programs. And, you know, this is my third time I have the privilege of being on with you, and I really appreciate that. And, you know, I think you're doing a great job of educating people on different timely topics, not just financial but other things. And, you know, I think that's a way that people can, the general public can, you know, be educated with some of these things with the various guests that you have on. And, and, you know, before we're done today, I hope to offer a few thoughts in regard to these 401ks and 457s and 403bs and those kinds of things.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, because you know what, that's what my desire is to deliver some content and help people improve their money, improve their business, improve their life, because it's, you know, it's all kind of all tied in. And since you mentioned, what was it, 427 or 520, whatever it's called, it's the college
thing. I don't say
it. It's the college program, right?
Oh, no, no. That would be a 529. But what I'm talking about is, you know, the aspect of, you know, people who work today, their pensions have been gone away, and they've replaced the pensions with 401. The employers have replaced those with 401k plans, sometimes 403b plans, 457 plans. These are what's called defined contribution plans. So,
gotcha.
To give you some industry lingo for our audience, there is that the traditional pension plan was what's called a defined benefit program, because it's defining what a benefit will be at a certain age, usually like 65, and what you put in there, we don't know what's going to be put in to accomplish that, but what we know is the end result. Where, as opposed to what they changed from that to these new plans, defined contribution plans, 401ks and so forth, which what's defined here is the contribution, what you're going to actually put into the plan. We don't know what it's going to look like at 65 years old, because that's the unknown. The known is what's going into the plan. And so these defined contribution plans that people have are anything from, you know, like I say, 401k plans. If you're working for a nonprofit or a school, you have 403b plans. Some municipalities and nonprofits have what's called 457 plans. And they're typically all working the same way, from the standpoint of allowing you to take money that you have earned and defer it to your retirement. What you receive for that is, for every dollar you put in, you get a tax break on that. So, you know, if you're in the 15% bracket, you know, for every dollar you put in, it's only costing you about 85 cents out of your pocket or out of your paycheck, if you have no state tax. If you're like Connecticut and have 5-6% state tax, it's costing you 80 cents out of your paycheck instead of a dollar out of your paycheck. So, and they can put that off and save that for the future. But, you know, so many times people don't know what's available to them. Like I said, last week I went down to this organization that was part of the city, local city. And some of those people there were putting into their 457 plan. Some of them were not. One was a 17-year-old kid just starting. I said, you know what, the best advice I can give you is put $5 or $10 or whatever the minimum is per paycheck into this 457 plan. And, you know, when you're an old man like I am, then you're going to be able to have quite a bit of money from that standpoint. And he shook his head. I'm not sure how much he got that, but but, you know, that's a way that we have been given to, you know, Uncle Sam says, you know, you put that dollar in your pocket, you're going to give me 20 cents of that. If you put that in the 401k plan, you can put up the whole dollar in the 401k plan. So these things that are available to people to save for retirement, to put them in better straits, is what's key for them to understand how they work. Yeah.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, and what I tell you, what's frightening, I was at a company, this is a few years ago, when I say a few years ago, 10, 12 years ago, I was at a company, and it was a small company. I think it had roughly 100 employees, maybe 110, so it was in that range.
Okay.
Out of 100-plus employees, the person who managed our 401k said that there was only two people on the company 401k program out of 100 plus people. I was one of them, and the owner of the company was the other one.
Oh, how about that?
It's frightening to know that so many people don't get it. And let me tell you, and what was so nice about this 401k, and this is very common, is that the company did a matching program, right, to a
nice
certain percentage. It's free
mm-hmm
money. I mean, how can you
exactly
pass up free money?
Exactly. And you know, that's one of the things people don't understand. I find that so many times. I say, does your company have 401k plan, and do they match? And they say, yeah, they do. And I say, you're not participating? No. I say, well, you're giving away part of your paycheck. I mean, they're going to pay you to save this money, and you're not doing it. So that's what I say to people, is that the minimum they should be putting into their 401ks and such is what the company is matching them. That's the minimum. As far as
right
how much you can put in, if you're under 50 years old, you can put in like $18,000, and if you're over 50 years old, you can put in $24,000 a year if you could afford that. But that's one thing people don't understand. But you're right. You know, a lot of companies do match, but not all of them match. But even if they don't, you're going to need to do something for saving for retirement. And we all know that back in the 70s or in this country, we did a lot better job of saving than we're doing today. And so we need to take advantage however we can. And typically our employers are paying for this 401k plan or whatever it is, defined contribution plan of some sort, that they're paying a good fee every year to manage that and administer that to be able to allow us to save on a tax-deferred basis, for our retirement. And
sure.
We need to take advantage of that.
Let me ask you this. Because, you talked about how the correlation between a college education and what do you call it, in retirement savings, that you,
uh-huh,
you found a correlation there.
Right.
There has to be, there also has to be, I guess, some mindset maybe correlation, maybe some parenting correlation, because it's still, even people who are college educated and even have graduate degrees and stuff like that, still, there's a small percentage of those people who are actually saving, right? I mean, it's
right.
It's not a huge percentage, like 20 or 30%. It's like in the percent, the single digit kind of a thing.
Right.
Do you think is it parental training that it needs to emphasize saving more? Is it a mindset? What other things are stopping people from saving?
Well, that's a very good point, because part of it is life, right?
Mm-hmm.
Life happens. I had a woman in here 2 weeks ago, and we went through and we talked about the allocation needed to be changed on her 401k. And, I'll stop there, but we talked about what needed to be changed on that. And, then she came in yesterday and 2 weeks later, and she hasn't made those changes. Now, she made progress on the things we talked about, so that's all good, but she didn't make those changes. Well, why? Because other things were pressing. And, when they took away the pension and they put it into our control, now it's in our control. That's the good part about it, but that's also the bad part about it, like you said earlier. Because if we don't do it, it's not going to happen. If we don't tell them we want to participate, it's not going to happen. If we don't increase the amount that we want to put in every year, it's not going to happen. If we don't change our allocations within how the money's invested, it's not going to happen. And, I'm believing that the market is going to drop like 50% or more here at some point. And, and that's what we were discussing, because she had over $100,000 in her 401k, and the market drops, and that goes from $100,000 to $50,000. She's going to be very unhappy. So we employed a strategy that was going to protect that for her and still allow her to invest in the market should the market keep going up. I don't see how it really can, but that's happened before. But that is the thing, is that too many times life happens. We're busy with the kids, we're busy with work, there's just so many things. That's one of the things. But one of the things, in a recent study that I read about this, is that college-educated people tend to have two things that generally speaking are above those that don't go to college. Number one is they have put off or have the concept of delayed gratification in the aspect of when they go and set off to go to college for 4 years, they're delaying their gratification for at least that 4 years to go out and get a real job kind of thing, sometimes longer than that. But they have the concept of looking to and thinking about the future. Secondarily, the self-control that's based upon that. But like you say, there's many people who are educated that still don't participate. And where does that come from? Well, you know, in my mind, you know, what I do for people can be, you know, I have a lot of clients who are smart enough to do what I do for themselves. The difference is it's not at the top of their list as far as what they maybe have the interest in. It's not at the top of the list as far as what they feel is the most important, because you're trying to raise kids, you're trying to, you know, move up in the corporate world, whatever it may be, and that tends to take precedent over some of those other things that are important, but not urgent and important. You know, you're probably familiar with the tyranny of the urgent.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think one of the myths about investing money or saving money. There's that myth that I don't have enough money as it is.
Yep,
I'm not,
right.
I can barely pay my bills, so there's no way I can save. And,
mm-hmm.
and you and I both know, everybody listening both know that the bills will always expand to consume all the money available.
Right.
So whether you're making a dollar a year or $1 million a year, you need to put some of that money aside, because crap happens no matter what
yep.
level you're at. And then, of course, the other thing is, if you're struggling to pay your bills now,
right,
and you're making, let's say, good money, or maybe you're making okay money, then maybe you need to cut back on your lifestyle. Maybe you cut back on Starbucks, or maybe you get a smaller house, or maybe you get a less fancier car, something to allow you to put money aside, because sooner or later – The money that you have will ultimately buy you the peace of mind that we ultimately want.
Right, right. And that's a good point. You know, like when I was talking to that young man, 17 years old, telling him to put part of his paycheck in, that's the best time to start putting it in when you don't have it. You start saving it when you don't have bills, because what happens is, you start getting a paycheck and you're going to spend as much of that paycheck as you can. And you're going to buy a car. You're going to do all these different things as a young person. But then what happens is, you might get a raise, and that's a perfect time to take the raise and start putting into your 401k or into the retirement plan, because that raise is new money. But I need that money. Well, yes, you do. But, you know, Bert, what I say is like, if you were my client sitting here with me, I'd say, Bert, I've got two clients sitting here today. I got Bert the younger, because you're younger than you'll ever be again. And
right.
I got Bert the elder. And my job is to make sure that Bert the younger doesn't spend Bert the elder's money. And, that's what happens so many times, is people don't think about the future. And if they just take whatever raises that they get and save those, they're used to living on the other amount. When people get money, there's two things they can do with it. Now, whether it's a tax return, it's a raise in your pay, it's switching to a new job where you're getting paid more, two things you can do. You can spend it and increase your standard of living. You can save it and increase your net worth. Actually, three things, right? You can do a balance of both. I mean, if it hurts that much to save the whole thing, you could use some of it in your standard of living, some of it in your savings kind of thing. But people have said to me in the past, Andrew, I can't save anything. Well, this does not account for inflation, but years ago people would say to me when I was doing seminars in churches on how to save money and put away for the future and stuff like that, they say, I can't save money, Andrew. I say, that's not true. You can save 10 cents a day. 10 cents a day turns into 25 cents a day. 25 cents a day turns into 50 cents, turns into a dollar. Pretty soon that turns into $50 a month. And, you know, it's not so much what you put away as much as the constant methodology of putting money away and keeping money away that counts. And people don't get these, but that's why you have a show like this, so that we can teach them about that. Right, Bert?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I love that idea. Look, it's not about, as you're saying, we can all start off small, right? Because it's a habit. So you're doing 10 cents a day and then 20 cents a day and then eventually 50 and a buck and stuff like that. And it adds up. And sometimes we have to overcome our fear and our own limited belief that we, quote, can't save or we, quote, don't have enough money. You know, that's just bull crap. You know, things do happen, but you're, you know, for the most part, you're in control of how you deal with that. We're out of time, but it's always good to have you on the show. Can't wait to have you back again. You know, I'd love to bring you back and talk about how to protect some of our assets. You mentioned this lady, this client of yours who's got $100,000 and some of the things that you're doing to protect her assets because, you know, markets always fall. They always go up, but they always fall. It's just the way markets are. And today we're up $100,000, and then before you know it, we're down $50,000. So I'd love to bring you back and talk about how to protect our assets.
Love to do that. And listen, I'd sing happy birthday to you, but I don't think the audience would appreciate that. So I hope you have a happy one and many happy returns, okay?
Thank you so much. Good stuff there from Andrew Ajemi. You know, if you want to find out more about Andrew, you can look up Ajemi. That's A-G-E-M-Y, A-G-E-M-Y, Financial Strategies, and he'll take care of you. Always good to have you on the show here. We appreciate your support, my friends. We appreciate your interaction with me on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and LinkedIn. And most of all, remember that you were created to succeed.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.